As we begin tonight, a couple of prefatory comments. First, I have a website that's pretty easy to find because it's just my first two initials and last name, all lowercase, no spaces, no periods, just tdgordon.net. And the reason I mentioned, I have a media ecology tab on that page, and I always put my most recent syllabus there. And the syllabus has a bibliography of about 8 or 9 pages at the back, which is mostly annotated. And the advantage of an annotated bibliography is you don't have the author's name and the title. You also have 2 or 3 sentences explaining what the book is about. So if you're the kind of person like me who's sometimes looking for what do I want to read when I'm sitting on the beach this summer or that sort of thing, feel free to go to the website, go to the media ecology page, find a syllabus. I will refer to certain people who've influenced me over the course of this weekend, and if you're intrigued by that, then you can go to that website and find information that will help you chase the matter down. Also, I'd like to thank Josh Espinoza for all of his help in preparing for this weekend. He's been staying in touch and trying to make a middle-aged person remember things without making it look like he's doing so. So thank you, Josh, for your doing. I will say that each of our sessions, as I've designed them and the handouts for them, bleeds over one to the other. In some senses, the ending of tonight introduces tomorrow, the ending of tomorrow introduces the second one tomorrow, and that one introduces Sunday morning. Of course, I understand that not everyone will attend all four. But for those of you who might be considering attending more than one, I'm trying to make each one naturally introduce the other without completely redoing the first one at the second. And so my concluding comments tonight will introduce my comments tomorrow evening. Our first session tonight is entitled, We Make Media and Media Make Us. If you were a student of cultural anthropology, you would use a more general term and say, we make tools, and tools make us. There is a reciprocity between human tool making and their tools. We make a tool for one purpose, and then we discover that it does more than what we purposed it to do. And so, the tools that we make reflect our values and our interests and our concerns, but they also shape our values and our interests and our concerns. The media tools that we make are just a subset of that. They're the media by which humans share what's in one heart or mind with another heart or mind, but they're still tools. And we make them, and they make us. If you have friends, nephews, students, daughters, sons, uncles, aunts that are cultural anthropologists, they will tell you that when archaeologists dig down under the earth and unearth the artifacts of another culture, they eventually write long, learned narratives about that culture based upon the tools they find. What tools did they make? And why? So if you know a culture's artifacts, what they make, what doesn't grow on trees, what they make, you know a culture. The tools that we make are shaped by us, and reciprocally they shape us. And so I sometimes think that the discipline of media ecology that Reed Schuchard spoke with you about before is really a subset of cultural anthropology that narrows itself down from all the tools that people make to the communication tools that they make. But we're still asking the question of how we make tools and tools make us. I discovered this in some sense unintentionally in 1985, I think it was. I added a room to our house in Massachusetts with my own little hands. It wasn't the most skillful sunroom ever made, but it did refute the notion that an academic can't do anything practical. And then I added a deck to it, and as I was determining, it was a 14 by 10 foot deck, just a small deck, determining where to dig the holes to put the sonar tubes in to pour the concrete for the foundation. I didn't want a trapezoid, I wanted a square deck, and so I measured out 10 feet, 14 feet with strings and sticks. And when I measured the diagonals, then I remembered my 10th grade geometry that a squared plus b squared equals c squared. Once the diagonals were the same, I had a square deck, and I started digging. So I was out there digging away busily, and my wife came out, and Diane said to me, "What are you making?" Calluses. Right? Because I became at that moment a media ecologist. An engineer only asks one question of a tool, and a media ecologist asks two. What does this tool do for us? It puts holes in the ground. What does it do to us? It puts calluses on our hand. Now, that's not a value judgment. It's a descriptive judgment. I used to play handball in college, and you wanted the hardest hand you could possibly find. When you first started playing handball, you used what they called a medium padded glove. Otherwise, you'd break the blood vessels in your hand. And then once you toughened up a little bit, you went to a less padded glove, and eventually you played with an open hand. But you wanted that hand to be as hard as the bottom of your foot, because the ball would really fly off. So if using a shovel makes your hand hard, that's a good thing if you're a handball player. If you're a neurosurgeon, maybe not. Right? But descriptively, it's still true either way, that every tool does something for us and something to us. We make tools, and tools make us. And to understand a tool, we have to understand not only what it does for us, which it was designed to do, but what other things it does to us that we may have not designed it to do. Most of us around the house have several tools that we use for things they were not designed to do. The first tool I ever took back to Sears, a Craftsman tool that I asked them to replace on the lifetime warranty, was a screwdriver in Philadelphia back when I was a student at Westminster Seminary. How did I break the screwdriver? I opened a paint can with it. Right? They have a tool to open paint cans. Most of us just grab a screwdriver and we crank away, and I knocked the tooth off of this Craftsman thing. And I went back in, and of course I was a young man, I was 23 or 24, and I looked like I was 16. And I go in there, and there's this gentleman there who was a wizened 58-year-old. And I said, "Sir, I broke this Craftsman tool." "Yes, sir, I see that you did." And I said, "Do you still have a lifetime warranty on your tools when people break them?" He said, "Yep, even when some fool tries to open a paint can with it." Right? So I had used the tool for what it wasn't designed to do. Right? But they still replaced it. Sears stood behind their product. Well, we make tools, and tools make us. As you and I try to make sense of media, we have to understand not merely what they do for us, but what they do to us. And so this helped me stay in touch with Nick and with Josh, but it also does certain things to us. We're trying to do both. We're trying to make sense of that. So in the history of technology, our culture tends to think if we can do a thing, we shall do a thing. But that has not always been the case. The fundamental difference between the Greeks and the Romans was the Greeks appear to have learned how to make certain things that they chose not to make. Apparently, the Greeks knew how to make the aqueduct and chose not to do it. The Romans later built it. Because the Greeks said the center of society is the town well in every town, and that's where people meet. and it's the thing that bonds people together socially. What will happen when the aqueduct bypasses those things? Where will people meet, and how will that influence us? And they said, well, we don't know, so they didn't build it. But the Romans said, well, by Jove, if we can build it, we'll build it. Right? So some cultures have been media tentative, and others have been media aggressive. The Greeks were media tentative, the Romans were media aggressive. And I probably lean a little bit more with the Greeks. Tools shape us. In the 19th century and 18th, the primary central musical instrument was the violin. And if you attend a classical concert even today, the conductor will be right in front of basically where I'm standing, facing this way, and there will be a horseshoe of people around him, of 8 or 9 people. And the one here is the principal violinist, and the other 9 are the first violinist. And then they spread out to the rest of them, the violas and so forth, cellos back down here. But the central instrument, literally, visibly central, was the violin. Now, if you're a fan of Ein Deutsches Requiem, the Brahms Ein Deutsches Requiem, as I am, you'll notice that of the 7 movements, the violins do not play 1 note in the first movement. The Selig Sein, die das Leid tragen, blessed are they who mourn. Not 1 note. And if you watch it live, there they sit right in front of the conductor, and they put their violins on their knees, and they do not string 1 note for 9 minutes. Now, they play furiously in the next 6 movements, but nothing in the first. And so the most significant instrument in the 19th and 18th century, Brahms simply didn't employ if he didn't need it. And he didn't want anything soaring up in this range in that first movement. He wanted a more plaintive sound in the first movement, so he just left it out. He knew to use a tool when it helped him, and not to use it if it didn't. But after Les Paul and several others found a way to electrify the guitar, which is otherwise a very old instrument, by the mid-20th century, it just blew every other instrument right off the surface of the planet. Right? I'm still not sure that it's a more competent instrument than a pianoforte, or an organ, or even a violin, but has replaced all the others because, see, we're Roman. Our culture is Roman. If we can electrify the guitar, we will electrify the guitar, and then we will use it. And we don't ask the question of how does that alter our whole sensibility of music, because we're not Greeks, we're Romans. If we can do it, we do it. And whether an electrified guitar is better than an acoustic guitar, and I think a case could be made that the acoustic guitar is lovelier. But get an old Martin 12 string that's been played for several generations and aged properly. A Martin 12 string has a beautiful sound to it, even if non-electrified. I don't mind a Les Paul made by the Gibson factory, but there's still something to be said for that acoustic one. But we're like Romans. This is the latest thing. This is what we've done. And so now all of the music in our culture has to be accompanied by electric guitar, nearly all of it, just because we can. Different culture. So what I want to suggest is that we make tools and they make us. We make tools that reflect our current values. But the tools that we make also shape our future values and those of our progeny. Tool making, in other words, is never neutral. My vegetarian friends don't need serrated knives in their house. If you're eating noodles and vegetables, you don't need serrated knives. And so the tools that we make reflect what's valuable. They reflect our values, and they shape our values. The first president of our country was what before he was a military figure? What did General Washington do before he served Lord Cornwallis. He was a surveyor. And what did the first president of the Confederacy do before he was the president of the Confederacy? Jeff Davis was a surveyor. You may recall that for 14 or 16 years in Congress, they wanted to build a transcontinental railroad that would connect the East Coast to the West Coast. And all of the northern senators wanted a northern route, and the southern senators wanted a southern route. Jefferson Davis was the chief surveyor of the southern route. Now, of course, once the southern states seceded, within like 3 weeks, someone called the question, Mr. Moderator, and they voted on the northern route. Right, and that's the route we have today. But think of it, that the first president of the nation and the first president of the Confederacy were surveyors, because with a big country with a lot of land that had not yet been developed, it was valuable to be able to survey. And so the tools that we made to measure land and so forth reflected our values, what was important to us. But they also shaped our values, what was important to us. It's just the nature of the way it is. The tools are never neutral. They reflect our values and shape our values. That's just what they are. So when we deal with media tools, the tools by which humans commune with one another, orality and so forth, all various ones, we ask two questions. What does it do for us? And what does it do to us? Both questions. What does a shovel do for us? Makes holes in the ground. What does it do to us? It gives us calloused hands. Do you want calloused hands? If you're a handball player, yes. If you're a surgeon, maybe not. But as a simple descriptive reality, it does something to us in addition to doing something for us. And so any alteration in the media by which humans communicate with one another alters the fundamental structure of human society and alters our human neurology. It reshapes what we regard as normal. It reshapes whom we contact and how. And it reshapes what we communicate thereby. The media shape the messengers. So Marshall McLuhan, in his first book, Understanding Media, Extensions of Man, the subtitle, Extensions of Man, McLuhan thought all media extend one part of our humanity, make us big-eared or big-eyed or big-mouthed, as it were, or big-nosed. I don't think we ever did one of those yet. So, for instance, the camera extends our eyes. Someone can take a photograph in another part of the world and send it to us, and we know what's happening there. The curvature of the Earth, you know, is 14 miles. If you're on the coast here and you're standing on the shore, you can only see 14 miles before the Earth curves away. And then if you go up in a high rise on the shore, having been on the beach 10 minutes earlier, on the beach you saw 14 boats out there, and you go up 5 stories up that high rise, you see 35 boats, because now you can see more than 14 miles, right? But with a camera, you're no longer limited by that, right? Someone somewhere else can be sending photographs. They extend your eye. The telephone extends the voice. Even big mouths can only yell from basically one side of a football stadium to the other. But you give them a telephone, and they can talk to people on a different continent. The voice gets extended. And so when McLuhan said that media are extensions of man, each medium extends one part of being human, the problem is it normally does it at the expense of other parts of being human. I know that you've had this experience. I've almost met no one who hasn't. Sometimes when you're at a symphony production, you actually close your eyes and listen, especially to the second Andante movement. Because instinctively you realize my eyes are distracting me. And if I wish to really hear this, I have to close my eyes and allow the ears to do their thing, right? And so the five senses that we have, in some sense, compete for our attentive waking moments. And when one is amplified, whether through a hearing aid or electronic pickup on a guitar or an amplifier or a pipe for an organ, then something else gets lost by comparison. And that's what people are wrestling with. What do we want to extend and at what sense? Luther knew in the 5 centuries ago that music, as he said, was next to the Word of God, the greatest gift that God has given us. Remarkable thing for him to have said, by the way. He also knew that if you didn't train young people in music, they would never really get it. But if you train them, they would. And now, because of fMRIs, we understand the neurology. We understand the biology of this. What happens is the nature of the way the brain is wired is the synaptic pathways that connect parts of the brain to other parts, 3 or 4 major lobes, they're not fixed. They rewire themselves all the time. And the neurologists call this neuroplasticity because it moves, or neurogenesis because the brain creates new neurological pathways. But apparently what happens is every effort we make to perceive something makes us more adept at perceiving a similar thing the next time. The brain is building. Like a baseball glove that you pick up at the sporting goods store, if you pound it with baseballs, it catches them well, but not softballs as well, which are larger diameter. But if you pound it with softballs, it catches softballs well, and baseballs not as well because it shapes to it. That's what we do. And so the media by which we apprehend the world are always reshaping us. If they did an fMRI of any one of us here today and did it again 3 months from now, it would not be identical because the brain is constantly rewiring itself in terms of what it has to deal with. And so in each of the major moments of human history, the media by which we have spoken and communicated to one another were not merely conveyances of our thoughts, our aspirations and loves and hates. They also shaped us as different people, because the brains of people who use the one versus the other or in different amounts are different. So I just want to walk through those with you, the 5 or 6, 7 basic moments in human media tonight. We'll chat a little bit more about that tomorrow night also. All cultures are oral. They all speak. We would probably say, if we looked at the development of the human race across time, that whatever we say about our friends who are Darwinian, whatever degree of agreement or disagreement we have, we would probably all agree on this: if they don't communicate, they're not humans, right? If the human, as Imago Dei, developed out of other species, and I'm incompetent to have an opinion on it, if it can't communicate, it's not the image of God, because the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit are everlastingly communicative. And so once the human species is the image of God, it's a communicating species, and therefore all cultures have an oral language. There are cultures today that don't have written languages. That's why we have friends at Wycliffe, because there are several thousand languages today that have never been written. Only 70 languages on the planet today are written. Over 3,000 are not written. Now, most of those 3,000 are spoken by small indigenous groups, off in the woods, hunter-gatherer cultures. They are numerically small. So probably only 8% of the human planet today doesn't have a written language. Probably 92 or 93% have a written language. But there are still cultures whose language has never been written. They're only oral. And cultural anthropologists can study them and study their brains, and they are different people than we are. They use their brain primarily to remember things because they can't write them down. Right? When I reach Terry's age, I will carry a little notebook in my pocket to write things down on to make sure I remember them. But in oral cultures, you can't do that because their language isn't written. And so what they do with their language in those cultures, what they do with their brain, is they remember things. And so the part of the brain that memorizes is huge in oral cultures. It's not so huge in ours because we just write things down. And so oral cultures promote memory. They also promote a consideration of the sources. If you want to learn to raise horses, for instance, and there's a person over here who's raising parakeets, and he says, well, I think you ought to raise horses this way, you say, well, what does this guy know about horses? Right? He's got parakeets. And so in oral cultures, you're always sizing people up. What do they know and not know? Is it the village idiot or the village fool? And so you're always making moral assessments of those from whom you learn. That's just the way oral cultures do. And Paul Johnson saw the opposite side of this when Paul Johnson wrote Not Modern Times, which was a great book, but when he wrote Intellectuals, he dealt with 8 or 9 influential Western intellectuals who, if you knew them, you'd have never listened to a thing they said. I think the first chapter starts with Rousseau, who abandoned his wife and 3 children, orphaned his children, abandoned his wife, and taught us about love of humanity. Well, hold on just a minute there, big fella. Right? How about loving the people you took a vow to and you brought into the world? And Paul Johnson's thesis was only the printing press permits us to care about the wisdom of people whose moral character we know nothing about. In an oral culture, you know everyone from whom you know everything you know because you know them, right? So oral cultures are people for whom memory is important and people for whom the assessment of personal character is very important. The fact that some editor put Rousseau in print does not overcome the fact that while he talked about love of humanity in general, he never actually loved a single human being in his life. And no one who knew him thought that he did. So he had almost no influence on anyone who knew him. His influence was through the printing press from people who did not know what a horrible human being he was. Because black and white is black and white. Doesn't make any difference. Manuscript cultures came along by the second millennium BC. It took a long time, by the way. I won't bore you with the phases. But writing by hand, manuscript in Latin, chirography in Greek, or handwriting, we call it in English. It took a long time. It took about 5 centuries to develop what you and I call an alphabet. The Old Testament that Moses wrote had no vowels. It was just consonants. And you and I could get along in English with just consonants if we had to. It's a little harder, but we could do it. Write a sentence. Just start with Genesis 1 sometime and write down N, capital N, T-H, B, G, N-G, G-D, C-R-T, T-H, H-V-N-S, N-D, T-H, R-T-H. And it'll say, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. But later they created vowels, and that made things a little easier, and they made spaces between words. Manuscript cultures allowed oral cultures to put some of the wisdom they learned in writing and not have to memorize it. And so it was, in some senses, a great step forward, but because they were writing on animal skin, and it was very expensive, and the goats didn't like it, they only wrote things they thought were very important. So when you read your New Testament, and 68 or 69 times it says, it is written, as a way of citing the Old Testament, that's not the only way they introduce Old Testament quotes. They also say, as God said, or as the Spirit said, or the second Psalm says, but roughly 70 times, 67 I think it is, gagraptai, it is written. That's also a sociological comment, not just theological. They're saying, this was so important, we sacrificed a goat to it, right? We wrote it down. And so when you see that, and it's the most common way that the New Testament introduces an Old Testament quote, when you see that, that's the expression of a manuscript culture saying, we wanted to make sure we didn't lose this. We didn't trust it to human memory. We wrote it down. So manuscript culture creates what we call gatekeeping cultures that decide that some things are worth recording for posterity. We have manuscripts of portions of the Greek New Testament that go back to the 3rd century AD. Because animal skins in an arid environment will last an enormous amount of time. And so when we etch stuff into a skin like that, it's because we believe it's timeless. If you go to the Lincoln Monument in D.C., you have the Gettysburg Address on the front, the second inaugural on the back. I would have inverted it. I think the second inaugural is a much more eloquent, and in fact, I think it's the most eloquent of all public speeches given in our nation's history. I would have inverted them. But they didn't put everything Lincoln ever wrote. They selected what they thought was worth chiseling into stone, right? Well, manuscript cultures were virtually the same. When they etched into animal skins, they wrote the things they thought were unusually important. But only about 3% of the culture was literate. You would never see a manuscript in those cultures. That's why, for me, one of the most interesting passages in the New Testament, I don't think it's theologically that important, but at least not in my sense, but the most interesting to me is when Philip encounters this gentleman who's going along in a chariot, and he's reading from Isaiah 53 as a sheep before his killers or executors, and as a lamb before the ones who struck him. He was quiet, and he didn't open his mouth. In humiliation, the judgment was expressed, and what should we say about his generation? And the person asked Philip, about whom was the prophet speaking, himself or someone else? Now, that's the theological question. And, of course, Philip says he's talking about Christ. Christ was the servant of Isaiah 53. But knuckleheads like me and Reed Schuchard were going, how did he get his hands on a manuscript of Isaiah 53? They were terribly expensive. It's like having a Rembrandt in your home. How did he get one of these? Right? And what does the text say about this one? He was the keeper of the treasury of Candace of Ethiopia. He was the curator of her museum. She was a royal person to whom royal gifts were given, and someone had to keep an account of that, and he was her treasurer, and that's the only way he got his hands on a manuscript. That's how expensive manuscripts were in that era. And so it's amazing that he even had his hands on one to be able to read it. Remarkable thing that he did this. When the printing press came along 3,500 years later, we would have had no useful printing press had we not had inexpensive paper. If you still are printing on goatskin, reading could never become a common cultural habit. But by the 15th century, with Gutenberg's printing press, we had inexpensive paper processes. And within 120 years, Elizabeth Eisenstein said 85% of Europe was literate. 3% of Europe was literate until the 15th century, and 85% was literate within 125 years of the printing. Without the printing press, you'd have never had the Renaissance, because their slogan was ad fontes, back to the source, back to the fountain. And they read Arabic manuscripts and Latin manuscripts and Greek manuscripts and Hebrew manuscripts. But if no one's printing them and making them available, you couldn't read them. And without the printing press, you have no Protestant Reformation, because how can you say, well, by my standard, the Pope is wrong if you have no standard, right? But once you could print Bibles, then you could print all of the Protestant little pamphlets and things and saying, where does the Pope get this perpetual virginity of Mary from? It's not in the Bible. People talk about Jesus' brothers and sisters in the Bible. Where do you get this idea that she never had any other children? Where do these indulgences come from? There's nothing in there in the apostolic. Where is this holding up the stuff and venerating at the Lord's Supper's elements? Where does that come from in the Bible, right? So all students of Western history say, no Bible, no Renaissance, or no printing press, no Reformation. No printing press, no scientific revolution. Because the way science works is people are working on complex, difficult things. And one person is perhaps measuring the external temperature of the skin of a frog in the daytime and the evening. And another is changing what happens when his diet is more acidic or more basic. And another is what happens when he's exposed to sunlight or not. And then they start publishing their results in Latin, in scholarly journals, and now they're each interacting with each other. And each realizes, I had a piece of the puzzle, but I didn't have the other pieces. And then they start putting the pieces together, and you have this explosion of learning that we call the scientific revolution. The debates, for instance, between Newton and Leibniz over the fundamental theorem of the calculus are irrelevant. If lightning had struck them both dead when they were 15, we would have the fundamental theorem today. And the reason is this. Once you had some people working with derivatives, and some people working with limits, and some other people working with other things, eventually some smart cookie would say, what happens if we put these three things together, right? It happened to be Leibniz in Germany and Newton in England. But if they'd both been struck dead when they were 10 years old, someone else would have discovered it. Because once they're starting to communicate with each other, knowledge explodes. So the printing press changes things for all time because we are able to express our thoughts with one another and engage each other. And of course, as Christians, we know this because it creates a culture of texts where there are texts that are widely known and we can talk about their meaning. What does it mean when Jesus says, let him who has ears hear? What does mending wall mean, right? And somebody says, well, good fences make good neighbors. It says it twice. And their friend says, yes, it does. It also says twice, something there is that doesn't love a wall. And that twice expressed thing is the first line of the poem and is in the mouth of the speaker. And it's his Neanderthal neighbor who keeps repeating his father's mantra, good fences make good neighbors. Now, I'm no definitive interpreter of Frost. In fact, I would be very suspicious of anyone who thought he were a definitive interpreter of Frost. I do know this. Once you have a text before you, you can have that conversation, can't you? You actually have a common text, and now the human mind becomes incredibly rational because it wrestles with alternative interpretations of texts. And we reason with one another as to what a text means. And oral culture can't do that. They memorize the essential things they have. How do you make a fire? How do you skin a deer? Right? Their memory consists of what is absolutely essential to survival. And they don't have the liberty to write religious or poetic texts and then to debate and discuss their meanings. And so when we say we make tools and they make us, this makes us rational. And it makes us imaginative. When you read a Tolstoy novel, or if you're strong enough to handle it, a Cormac McCarthy novel, and I don't recommend that for the faint of heart, though I love him, you literally create the images that they describe. No two people read Tolstoy's Anna Karenina the same way. Because when they have the images of the peasants out in the field, all you have is a written description of it. And each individual person creates an image. Now, if you're from a flat part of the country here towards the coast, you think of fields as being flat. In western Pennsylvania, they're a little hilly, right? Now, Tolstoy doesn't say whether it's flat or hilly. You fill all that in, and you create it all. You're co-creator with Tolstoy. And so both the rational properties of the mind and the imaginative property of the mind are on steroids when they read. And so whatever books do for us, they give us information, they do much more to us. They change us, and they make us different people. The reading mind is a different mind. Now, so you have oral language up until the point of manuscripts in the 2000 BC. Then you have language up to 15th century AD. Then you have the printing press for roughly 400 years. And then you have electricity and the camera created within 2 years of each other in the late 1840s. And at that point, language, which has been growing and growing and growing and growing, for the first time tapers off. Because it competes with image. And that's why by 1969, you have the book, Why Johnny Can't Read, after which both of my little books were named. That what happens is, all of our media prior to that were language-based, and now we have image-based. And they require nothing of your imagination. Seeing a sunset requires only that your eyes still work. A novelist using words to describe it makes your mind work overtime. And if you do neurological studies, fMRIs of people who are looking at a sunset versus reading about a sunset, there's much more activity when you read about it. Isn't that interesting? Now, I'm not saying I want to trade the two. I'm just saying it's just a different thing. It shapes you differently. Language makes you a different person. So what happens is, by the time of the middle of the end of the 19th century, and I would say, popularly speaking, by the end of the 19th century, early 20th, we now have electronic technologies and photographic technologies. And the photographic technologies, if you think of a seesaw on the playground, as language goes up, image goes down. As image goes up, language goes down. If prior to photograph, most of our waking life was language, after the photograph, a good portion of it is image. It just changes us and what language does for us. And then what the electronic technologies do is they permit us to make contact with people who are at some distance. I think I've got something here from Nick earlier when I was at the airport. What electronic technologies do is they allow a person in Boston to send a telegraph to a person in Texas. And so if you think of your seesaw, the proximate and the distant, they change for all time our understanding of who's close and who's not. In fact, as recently as when I was young, which was when President Lincoln was president, we used to use the expression close friends. Some of you have used that expression. He or she is a close friend. Because if a person wasn't close to you in proximity, they couldn't be a dear friend. Now we probably say a dear friend because we Facebook and text and so forth, and our friends have nothing to do with their physical proximity. But there was a time in which, in God's providence, our close friends were actually those who were close to us. In fact, that's my common reading of the parable of the Samaritan. A lot of people went past this person, and only one of them cared for him. Who's my neighbor? The one who's close to you that you can care for. Well, I can't care for people who are thousands of miles away. But I might be able to care for someone who lives down the street. And so the electronic technologies, according to Marshall McLuhan, change for all time what it means to answer the question, who is my neighbor? Because McLuhan said, we watch the news every night and we see tsunamis and the eastern part of the world, and we can't really help. But Mrs. Smith, the old widow Smith, just came home. Her husband died 5 years ago. She needs someone to make her a casserole, and no one even notices when she hobbles down her sidewalk on crutches, even though she's two houses away, because we're busy watching things 2,000 miles away about which we can do nothing. So forever, the electronic technologies alter the nature of village, the nature of community, because the proximate becomes more distant and the distant becomes more proximate. That's just what they do to us. Whatever they do for us, I'll leave to others to decide. And then what the digital media do, some people weren't sure we would call these their own thing. What digital media do, they are image-based and electronic, but because they are small and portable, they are ubiquitous. And so at least mercifully, growing up in the 60s, the telephone was attached to a wall somewhere and you could escape it. And the television was attached to a wall somewhere and you could escape it if you wanted to go read about the Hardy Boys. You cannot escape these. Even if you're clever, as I am, I'm quite clever. I thought I'd pull up a Greek text. It's a Hebrew text. I kind of like my original text Bibles, but watch this. This is my favorite thing. It's the off button. If you turn that thing off, nobody can reach you. It's wonderful, right? It's just great. Just turn it off. But if you don't, anyone can reach you, including Espinoza. Anyone can reach you if you leave the thing on, right? And so the digital technologies are their own thing because they have all of the shifting of visual image base, and they have all of the proximate distant changes of electronic, but they're also portable, and you cannot escape them. They are, like the Holy Spirit, ubiquitous. They go everywhere. So my Robert Frost, my collection of Robert Frost with all 9 volumes in one, sits on the shelf patiently and leaves me alone until I say, well, I haven't read Birch's recently, or Ovenbird, so I think I shall read, or Into My Own. And then I pick it off the shelf. Other than that, Robert Frost doesn't bother me. But think of how many people bother us in a given day with these. They are literally alarming. They have alarms on them. And so the human ability to concentrate for extended attention spans, which we'll talk about in our second talk tomorrow, is greatly atrophied by these, because the brain that is frequently distracted gets good at distraction and poor at concentration. So the digital world has enormous effects on executive attention span, as we will see later this week. So it is a distinct era. It's analogous to the visual technologies. It's analogous to the electronic technologies. But because you can't leave them behind, and they go with you everywhere, they're much more influential over you than the visual and the electronic were. So I want to pause there. That's enough for tonight. You've been bored plenty. But I want to pause there and see if you have questions to make sure you've understood these sort of fundamental and basic kind of concepts and our race through the 5 or 6 basic moments in media history. If I can answer those questions, I'll do it. We'll pick up again tomorrow.